The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Good morning and welcome to Hour 2 of the Bible Study on listener-supported KFUO Radio. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour. KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, here's some very basic ground rules for this hour of the program. Anyone can follow them. It's very simple. Any question, any comment, pretty much anything is fair game. If you've seen something in the news, heard something in church, perhaps something your pastor said in a sermon didn't quite make sense and you want some clarity on it, now's a perfect time to call in. If you didn't get a chance as we went through the first 10 verses of Exodus to call in with a question or a comment or even email one in, you can certainly do that now. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. And it's always fun when a pastor comes into the studio and you go and he says, well, what are you going to do today? What are we going to talk about? And you go, well, you know, the end of the world is coming. He goes, yeah, so what's new? Pastor John Elwick joins us from Emmaus Lutheran Church. One of the older, can I call it a charter congregation here in the St. Louis area for the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod?
We're not a charter congregation, but we are of a very old daughter of Historic Trinity, tied right into that, but not actually a charter.
So virtually from the beginning.
Very close.
Your congregation has been there. It's a bit of a challenge. You're an urban congregation in the city of St. Louis.
Yes.
But things are going well, I hope?
Fairly well. Emmaus has had an interesting trajectory in that it started out, as I said, a mission known as the Jefferson Avenue Mission, grew, and then during the transition times of the 50s and the 80s, the church went from having been one of the largest in the St. Louis area to very small. And now we're slowly rebuilding, so I kind of joke that we're Jefferson Avenue Mission all over again.
All over again. Well, so long as you proclaim Christ and you administer the sacraments rightly, everything is doing well.
Yep.
Baptizing?
Yep.
Yeah. When you asked about what are we going to talk about this morning, and I talked about the end of the world, this subject has been around because of the whole Mayan calendar 2012 business, and there was the that really, really bad movie about 2012 and the cataclysm that was supposed to come. But on the serious side, apparently somebody's taken the time to do some surveys, and they have found that nearly 15% of people worldwide believe that the world is going to end in their lifetime. And specifically, 10% of the world population, now you can't survey everyone, obviously, but of those who were surveyable, 10% think the Mayan calendar is going to signifying that the world's going to end sometime near the end of 2012. Does that bother a pastor, the world's going to end?
No, I mean, obviously we've been looking forward to this, and I mean that quite honestly as a Christian. We're looking forward to the end of this world, and we have been since Christ's ascension, you know, which we'll be celebrating again in about a week and a half,
yeah.
As we're looking, as we're looking forward to that, you know, this is something that if you look at it, it appears that the apostles were looking forward to, the early church was very much so looking forward to, Luther throughout history. We're looking forward to this day when the world does come to an end. So the idea that the world's going to come to an end, does that bother me? No. In fact, there are times that I find myself praying, come Lord Jesus, you know, joining with John at the end of Revelation there.
Yeah, one more day? Really? One more day? Really?
You know, obviously, we also have to remember, like Paul said, to live is Christ and die is gain. So to be here in this world and for the Lord to be long in this world is a blessing to us Christians. And it also is a message to us that the work of the church and Christ's Spirit's work of making disciples is not complete yet. You know, there is still more to be harvested for the kingdom before the end comes. So it's a reminder of that as well. So we shouldn't be too eager.
The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few.
Right.
You know, you could use a little bit of help, couldn't you? When you talk about being a mission congregation, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we definitely are working on that as far as trying to find ways to to reach out. But the Lord continues to provide for us and guide us in that as well.
Here's an interesting quote from Karen Gottfried. She was the research manager for Ipsos Global Public Affairs, which, again, this survey covered over 16,000 people in 20 countries. She said, whether they think it will come to an end through the hands of God or a natural disaster or political event, whatever the reason, 1 in 7 people thinks the world is going to end this year. 1 in 7.
That seems staggering, doesn't it? But yet, yeah, I remember when I was a child in the 70s, there were the newspaper talking about a comet that they were predicting was going to crash the world and end the world. And as a little kid, what really bothered me, and you know, now you get a little jaded because, well, yeah, we had that in the year 2000.
Yeah.
The world was supposed to come to an end, at least economically, if
Y2K,
not physically,
yeah,
with all the Y2K stuff.
12 years ago, the world was supposed to end.
You know, and the one thing is that Jesus tells us no one knows the day or hour. And so I've always kind of humorously thought of when people make predictions, that it's kind of like God in heaven saying, nope, going to mark that one off. It's not going to be that day. Obviously, it's the reverse. You know, God's not responding to us, but human guesses are always going to be wrong because Jesus tells us so.
You know, of all the things, now this is what shocked me about this survey. Do you know who is the least pessimistic about the world ending this year?
No, I don't.
The French.
The French, really?
The French. Only 6% think that the world is going to end. Do you know who the most pessimistic is? The Turks.
Really?
22% of the Turkish people surveyed think the world's going to end this year.
Really? Now, that surprises me.
And there you have a Christian nation as opposed to a Muslim country. Well, technically a secular democracy.
You know, France is largely atheistic now.
Yeah.
I know somewhat indirectly some missionaries in France, and it is brutally tough to try to do Christian missions there. So for that regard, I would consider it much more of a secular country. And that way, it doesn't surprise me. The Turks does surprise me some because there's a lot that are looking forward to that worldwide caliphate and all that come.
The Islamic hegemony that's
predicted,
yeah.
And so I would have thought that there would be a bit more going that way with it. But then again, Turkey, while an Islamic state, is also a semi-Western democratic state. And so it's a mix. It's not really...
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, one or the other.
You know, some other interesting things that I pulled out of this. About 1 in 10 globally said they were experiencing fear and anxiety about the world ending in 2012. With the greatest number of people experiencing anxiety about this in Russia and Poland.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know what to make of that, but I just thought, you know, the data is there. They don't really mine the data for any meaning. They just say, well, here are the raw numbers. But the whole idea that people are actually anxious about this, they're afraid, they're fear, you know, perhaps it's an opportunity for the church to speak to that anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, it could very well be, as long as the church, you know, we rise up to the challenge and do it appropriately. I felt like the Y2K thing, there were too many in the church that were actually alarmist about it, and that undermined our witness at that time. But... to be able to speak words of comfort and hope during those times could be a useful thing. I know the other way I've heard that there's also a lot of tourism right now from Mexico because people want to go down to the land of the Maya during the last year.
Look at the picture they've got with the Reuters story.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
There it is, that Mayan temple is, or the calendar.
Yeah, the Mayan pyramid there.
Yeah. You know, the thing that they also have to throw in here is they have to talk about how primarily the people who respond that they're afraid the world is going to end this year tend to be of lower education and lower income levels. So I guess if you survey a trailer park, they think the world's going to end this year. You know, why they throw that in, I'm not quite sure. But again, it's factual. It's not, they don't draw any meaning from that. You know, there's another bit. Did you catch the news last night, local news? I know you had a worship service and then you were called to some pastoral duties at a hospital. But did you catch local news?
No, I did not.
Did you know there's this controversy swirling out there? Apparently there is a Republican lawmaker, state representative, who made a big spiel yesterday about coming out and declaring that he was a homosexual.
I did read about that earlier in the day.
Yeah, because there is a piece of legislation which, you know, and this again just goes to emphasize why, since the bird died, I don't have much use for the Post-Dispatch. There's an article in the Post-Dispatch about this, and you go through the entire story, and never once does it refer to the House bill by its proper name, which is House Bill 2051. They just keep referring to it as the so-called Don't Say Gay Bill. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for edifying me, Post-Dispatch. It's not called the Don't Say Gay Bill. Would you like to hear the text of that little piece of legislation that's percolating its way through the House of Representatives here in the state of Missouri?
Yeah, please.
And you tell me. Now, you're the pastor. You're the professionally trained theologian here. You know, you've got a pulse on how people think about things and how they react. You tell me what you find maybe really offending people in this piece of legislation that was proposed. Notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, no instruction, material, or extracurricular activity sponsored by a public school that discusses sexual orientation other than in scientific instruction concerning human reproduction shall be provided in any public school. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from that, where do you extrapolate don't say gay, for example? And what would you find offensive about that piece of legislation?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that tolerance has changed, and that, you know, when I grew up, tolerate was something that you meant you put up with something or accepted something you really didn't like. You know, I tolerate pain, for instance. Or in a more political arena, the idea was that you hear people say this from time to time: I disagree with you completely, but I would die fighting for your rights to believe that and to
sure,
say that.
Sure.
However, today there is, that's been divided. There's now, they talk about that, is referred to as negative tolerance. But then there's positive tolerance, which is not only accepting their being there, so to speak, but it is also embracing that and saying that that's good for you. You know, and even if, say, I'm not going to take the gay lifestyle, it's good for you to have it. And that's considered positive tolerance. And then anything that you do that is not embracing it is considered intolerant because you're not being positively tolerant. You're not embracing it.
You're not affirming it.
Right.
You know,
and what we have seen, and this has been, you know, on track for a number of years. I just recently read, I believe it was Time Magazine in 1992, made the observation that there was a dramatic shift in the homosexual rights movement in that they were moving from being accepted by society to being embraced and celebrated by society. And what if that is your goal, then to have this bill saying that, hey, the public schools cannot celebrate you, they consider that to be hateful, to be, you know, wrong, evil, etc. So yeah, that's really kind of where that's coming from. And you think about it, there's, you know, coming up here in St. Louis, I just recently saw the billboards this morning, actually, for the gay pride parades. It's not just allow
us. Is it that
us,
time again? You see, that always catches me unprepared. Is it that? Really? Is it?
I didn't notice the dates.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Heaven
but
forbid. Heaven forbid.
Yeah, but, you know, the idea is that, again, it's something to be proud of. It's something to embrace. It's something to do publicly, you know, down the streets of the city. And should be embraced is their idea, and that those of us who say, wait a minute here, I am very willing to, in a civil level, accept you in the old-fashioned tolerance. Say, you live your lifestyle the way you want to, but don't ask me to endorse it. We're offended by it, and we see that as forcing their views on us, but they flip it around and saying that if we don't embrace it, we're forcing our views on them, and that's where I think he's talking about don't say gay bill.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, keep it quiet. They're accusing us of trying to shove them back in the closet, I think.
But in reality, you know, we all watched President Harrison go before the Congressional Committee talking about the Health and Human Services mandate, about how I think he said quite boldly, you know, we are called to obey God. And when the state conflicts with what we are called to do in God's word, then we will have to challenge the state. And this is about school districts not forming the social conscience of your children, but letting parents form the, especially on this issue.
Right.
You know, about if you want to tell your children and raise them in a household that says that homosexuality is a sinful behavior. I know that the church has been in many cases, sort of abusive how it pursued that line. But setting that aside for a moment, it's your privilege as a parent, don't you think, Pastor, to raise your children in an ethical standard, a worldview that you deem appropriate? And who's the public school then to come in and say, you know, mom and dad are dopey, let me tell you what to do here?
Yeah, I agree. The problem is that the school district is going to form the social mores of the student regardless, you know, in some way or another. You know, even to the benign, shall we say,
okay.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Wait your turn when you get at the drinking fountain. This is teaching you, the social standards that you go to a ball game, you want to get a drink from the concession stand, you don't elbow your way to the front, you wait your line and turn. And these are social things that are happening there. And the challenge is that, who dictates what that's going to be? Because the fact of the matter is, when you have a group of people together, there is going to be sociological structures, and there are going to be spoken or unspoken pressures and, implied, at least, values of that group. The question comes, number one, who dictates that? And that's one of the big things here. And number two is, how free are you to dissent? Because this is one of the problems that's happening in public schools around the country, and I think one of the things that's behind this particular bill is what's happening now is that students are being punished, literally punished, to where they're being suspended and rights withdrawn from them to speak and things like that if they will say, hey, I don't agree.
Right.
And so now we're seeing that those values being flipped. But I think there's always going to be that structure, or struggle, rather.
Well, when it comes to, be kind, share, wait your turn, raise your hand, sort of the Warden June Cleaver view of culture that we have, I think most parents would agree that that's fine, that there's sort of that common natural law that dictates that these are proper social behaviors. But now we're getting into, like you said, affirming certain lifestyle choices and educating children in these things at an age perhaps that... For example, I interviewed the Alliance Defense Fund, one of their attorneys, that was fighting on behalf, I think it was the Camden County Schools, just south of St. Louis, down Lake Ozark region,
Camden County,
because the ACLU and a pro-gay organization didn't like the fact that their internet policy banned children, under 18 children, from going to gay websites. Use your don't use your imagination, Bill.
Yeah.
But you can imagine what you might find on such a website.
Mm-hmm.
And the school district was sued that they had to give children access to these materials. And as I recall, I think that suit was won by, the school district, the Camden County School District, was forced, I think, to provide access to these websites. To me, that seems awfully extreme that,
Yeah,
I don't know. As the father of two girls, I marvel at the world that we are corbeling together for ourselves.
Right. Oh, I agree. And part of it too is the age that these things are being pushed.
If you want to go to college, go to college. You're 18.
Right.
You're considered an adult in the eyes of society. You're legally an adult. You're emancipated from your parents, though you may be stuck to their checkbook. But fine. But kids under 18, for crying out loud, this is. Let's bring one of our callers in on this. Herman is out there. Herman, thanks for the call this morning.
Yes, I think maybe with your media resources there earlier on the station today, I think there was a news broadcast that the United Methodist National Assembly, I believe, voted down by a large margin the homosexual resolution. Do you have any follow-on that?
I knew that it was coming up for consideration. Where I go for such information, a good website, is the Institute on Religion and Democracy. You can find them at theird.com or .org.
Apparently, if that is the case, then they're watching what happened in some other denominations that went that way and don't care to see the consequences, apparently.
Well, in one sense, I say that's good. I'm very happy for that. I'm thankful any time that Christians stand up for biblical morality, although I'm a little bit concerned if, Herman, you're right, that it's for fear of repercussions and that they're not doing it because Scripture tells us this is wrong, that God has warned us against this, but rather we don't want people getting mad at us and leaving and taking their money with them. That, of course, concerns me, but You know, it's a tough situation, and it is rampant, and it's something that is putting pressure on virtually every church body. There's a lot of pressure even within the Roman Catholic Church, and people always think of that as a bastion that's going to fight against these sorts of things. But these things are happening all over.
Herman, thank you for the call.
Thank you, Pastor.
You know, isn't it interesting, Pastor, that you know, at one time, if you wanted to be hip and cool, you were considered to be unorthodox. And now if you want to be countercultural, be orthodox.
Yeah. Well, what I think was a really interesting story a while back, not that I follow these things a whole lot, but there was all the controversy about Tim Tebow, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a point where some students got in trouble at a school, a public school, for Tebowing, which is, as I understand it, bowing on one knee, I guess, the way that Tim Tebow does. And they were doing this in the school, and I thought that was really fascinating, that how our society has changed to where the countercultural, rebellious thing to do is a public display of faith, emulating, in this case, a sports star. But, you know, I thought that was just fascinating that you go back 30, 40 years ago, and it was just the opposite. And now, you know, a student can rebel by actually acting religious.
You know, here's one of the pull quotes from the story. I was, you know, scanning this very quickly here to see who said this, but it's an interesting point that he makes. I find it interesting, in reference to this piece of legislation and the challenges being brought against it, the distortions being brought against it. It says, I find it interesting that some of the critics of this bill who consistently rail about keeping government out of our bedroom now want to put the bedroom into our public schools. Isn't that a brilliant quote?
That is a great soundbite.
I got to go back and give attribution to that, because it's somewhere earlier in the story here, somebody named Jones in the Post-Dispatch story. But that is a brilliant observation of what's going on.
That really is.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I'll note, and again, I have not talked with Representative Steve Cookson, who is the sponsor of this bill. He's from the 153rd District, which I guess is like Poplar Bluff, that area.
Okay.
About why this, why he put this bill forward. Was interesting, though, when I called his office this morning, as you know, I said I have a weekend program at Studio 8. It's sort of a news magazine program. This would fit as an interesting story. And in the Post-Dispatch, he's quoted as saying that the bill's true intent has been distorted. And I said to his administrative assistant there, I said, well, would you like access? I said, we're owned by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I said, if you saw Matthew Harrison, this goes to the heart of what we're talking about, religious freedom, that sort of thing. And I tell you, the fear, you know, who are you? Why are you calling? What was the radio station again? We issued a press release. I think it was interesting to note, and again, I'm not judging that, because they don't know who I am, so I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, but it just struck me that the reaction was that they've been so beaten up by the press. Even the Colbert Report on has picked this up and sort of beat it around, like, oh, those cave-dwelling troglodytes in Missouri and don't know homosexuals exist. Oh, what do you... You know, don't even want to come on a Lutheran Christian radio station that's simpatico to what the guy holds and talk about this.
Yeah, the fear level is immense. Because, first of all, there's a lot of political power within it. There's a lot of social power, as you see, with how the press reports and quite honestly twist things. I always find it fascinating how the press reports things and the terms they use, because just choosing terms is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, if you pick up any major mainstream news outlet, be it print or online or on television or whatever, and on the abortion debate, you have pro-choice and abortion rights opponents, you know? And those terms very much so bias anything else you say with it. And again, that they will not name the bill in it, but call it the so-called, really, again, biases all of that.
And they don't bother to mention who calls it the so-called
right.
Don't Say Gay bill.
But the other thing that we have to understand is that this is an era of gotcha journalism, too, and they were probably fearing that.
Yeah, and like I said, even when you say, hey, here's our website, go look, see the other programs we've done, still very concerned about just what might happen if Representative Crookson, I welcome you. You know, Pastor Helwig, he's doing quite fine. He hasn't fled the studio yet. He's, I think, enjoying himself from the smile on his face. You can join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
Dr. C.F.W. Walther once told his seminary students, "I wish to talk the Christian doctrine into your very heart, enabling you to come forward as living witnesses with a demonstration of the Spirit and of power. I do not want you to be standing in your pulpits like lifeless statues, but to speak with confidence and cheerful courage." Today, Concordia Seminary still strives to do just that.
When you exercise, it all counts. You don't need to join a gym to get the benefits of exercise. Go for a walk, ride a bike, or take the stairs. Do 10 minutes of exercise at a time. Just try to get in 150 minutes a week. Exercise relieves stress, helps maintain a healthy weight, and builds strong bones. It all counts.
Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itallcounts. Brought to you by the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services and the Health Resources and Services Administration.
This is a test of the emergency alert system.
The Apostle Paul once wrote, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Of course not, because you're serving Him. Hi, I'm Mark Hawkinson, a fellow servant, along with you. Indeed, no labor for the Lord is going to be in vain because you're talking about the name that saves. That's never in vain. I'll talk more about it this Sunday on Moments of Assurance at 9:15 a.m. on KFUO Radio.
Four words added to the Pledge of Allegiance during the height of the Cold War, One Nation Under God, are the theme of today's 61st Annual National Day of Prayer. Shirley Dobson chairs the National Day of Prayer Task Force.
Ronald Reagan said, "If we ever forget that we are one nation under God, we'll be a nation gone under." And we are forgetting God, and our nation is going under, and the only way back is on our knees.
Congress established the Day of Prayer in 1952, and in 1988 declared it would be held every year on the first Thursday in May.
We're facing a lot of challenges in the 21st century, and people need to be on their faces before the Lord in repentance and in prayer for this country.
Dobson told CBN News The 700 Club that Americans can attend any of the tens of thousands of prayer gatherings scheduled today.
They need to go on our website, nationaldayofprayer.org, and they can find out where there's an event in their area.
I'm Steve Coleman.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
When it comes to protecting unborn babies from abortion, these young people are going the extra mile, over 1,000 of them to be specific. Jimmy Becker and Mike Schaefer founded Biking for Babies 4 years ago to raise money for pro-life groups. This year, 10 will be biking from New Orleans to Chicago and hope to raise $40,000 to benefit crisis pregnancy centers. The year these bikers were born, over 1 million babies were aborted. Jimmy said, "We're riding for those who aren't here to ride with us." They stay at churches and host families along the way while giving talks on abortion. So if you see them on the road in late May, give them encouragement. You can learn more about these bikers by visiting today's broadcast link at lifeissues.org.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Good morning and welcome back to the Ask the Pastor Hour here on the Bible Study at KFUO Radio. I'm Roland Lettner. Our guest pastor this morning is Pastor John Helwig from Emmaus Lutheran Church in the city of St. Louis. I guess what, technically, is that South City where you are? What?
Yes, South City.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can see why I started you with a story about the end of the world. because from here you can see it, I think. Let's go to the phones and talk with our callers. Pumtree, good morning. Thank you for the call.
Good morning, sir. I am so happy that we have a station that easily talks about religion and Jesus Christ. But I am worried about one thing. Lately, I have noticed, I listen every day to KFUO. Why are we just now discussing a lot of homosexuality? It's been around just like prostitution. I don't want it. I don't believe in it. But why do you take time up and talk about it?
Well, because this is a news-oriented program that a pastor responds to from a theological Lutheran perspective. And this is part of Scripture. And how culture treats it goes directly to how they value what the Bible does or does not say.
Okay, I accept that. I don't question the Bible. I don't. I just try to learn about it. That's all.
Well, we appreciate you listening. Thank you.
Yeah, and Puntry, you're right that this is something that has been around throughout history. It was something that was part of all the ancient cultures, Greece, Rome, and all that sort of thing. This is not in any way a new kid on the block issue at all. So,
but okay, I accept that. I accept that. You are learned and I listen. Thank you.
Very good, sir. Thank you for the phone call this morning. Now, to the point, that is an excellent question that the caller asks. Why are we talking about this? I mean, we could go to, what is it, Leviticus, and we can talk about it, or we could talk about Sodom and Gomorrah and that sort of thing. But the broader issue here is how this affects your vocation as a pastor. It's about how this affects what you can or cannot say from the pulpit. And it also is about how culture reacts to that. We were talking off air during the break about how churches have been attacked and vandalized. We talked about this particular representative, and rightly so, with suspicion. Who are you? Why do you want to talk to this person? Because there is such an atmosphere of fear that is compressed down on Orthodox Christian doctrine in this culture.
Yeah, this is it's a real issue of the fear, the pressure. For instance, pastors have been jailed in Canada.
They have.
Over this. I know of at least one instance where there was a Christian speaker from the United States going to Canada, going through the customs as he's in the airport entering Canada, and they asked the regular questions, where are you from, what are you doing here? And he says, I'm a Christian speaker. You're not going to talk about homosexuality, are you? His topic was not that at all. He has a concern about it, but that was not his topic, but that they immediately jumped on that and gave the impression, apparently, that he might not have been allowed into the country if his topic was homosexuality. And this is one of the things that is really disturbing, is that while on the one side we're hearing that the homosexual, the gay, lesbian, bisexual community has rights and they should be heard in the public square, and which I'd say in the civic realm, yes. But on the other side, there's so much pressure saying, but anybody who disagrees with them should not be allowed to be heard in this public square and should be browbeaten down. That's wrong, too. We should, with this nation, the separation of church and state, and our freedom of speech and all of those things, we should be in a situation where we can all talk about this calmly, rationally, peacefully. There should not be violence on either side. There should not be public shunning or anything like that on either side. But, openly, honestly talking about it, getting to know one another, understanding the perspectives and that, and to where we can say, these are our concerns. The Bible tells us that this is, improper, and we have these other, sociological concerns or actually physical problems that are caused by it and all those sorts of things. But to be able to do so in an open, honest environment to where we're not telling them to shut up and they're not telling us to.
The remarks by President Harrison before that federal congressional committee or subcommittee, I don't remember exactly which it was, it may have been a subcommittee. What he had to say there, this declaration of faith that he professed before these congressional representatives, was nothing new or original to Matthew Harrison. This has been echoed by the church for centuries, every time the state came knocking on the door and said, you serve us, not the other way around.
Yeah.
And this is why we talk about these things, because, you've got Bonhoeffer and Niemöller, in Germany in World War II and so many others, and then it goes even prior to that. The whole idea about the Health and Human Services mandate, where the government comes along and says, essentially, the heck with your doctrine. We'll tell you what's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the proper role of the two. That's blending the two kingdoms, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not new either. I mean, human nature is to blend the two kingdoms. We want to impose, our own will on the structures that God has created. And you're right. This has been a struggle all the way through. And I guess, within the Christian church, it's been a struggle really since 313 when Constantine legalized Christianity. Before then, it really wasn't an issue other than the meddling was, depending upon the situation, repent or recant the Christian faith, or you're going to be thrown to the lions or right. whatever.
Barbecued, whatever the case may be, sawed in half, a number of different
right.
things the saints endured.
You know, one of the ones I've always looked at that amazed me was St. John Chrysostom, who was Bishop of Constantinople, and he actually excommunicated the emperor at one point.
Yes.
And I think, wow, you want to talk about somebody who had some guts. I don't know if I would have the guts to do it. I would hope I would in that necessary. But you know, these battles have gone on, and you know, during my seminary training, I took an entire course on just the struggles between the papacy and we're talking in the Middle Ages here, so that's the entirety of the church, and the emperors of the Holy Roman Empire during the Middle Ages. This is a relatively small thing. You could easily do a full course on this because there is so many battles between these two environments, and it continues today. And
well, we tend to neglect where the church stood up and rightly contended against the government, but we tend to focus more on, well, look at Charlemagne. Well, let's go pay a visit to the Saxons. We'll baptize them and cut their heads off. That way they can't recant. Not the best theological choice, you know.
Right.
But that's the painting that's done of Christians. They forget the other side of it, that the St. John Chrysostom's, that there is the true Orthodox faith for which we must stand.
Right. Yeah, and you know, there are those that have done that. You know, I'm always reminded, though, of Dr. Robert Kolb, who points out that as a German, our ancestors were probably converted to Christianity at the point of Charlemagne's sword, so maybe some good came out of it. Not advocating those methods at all.
No, God works all things to his good.
He does work with it. But, and that's one of the things I think is important, too, is that people point to these times. You know, you have the Crusades, which are greatly misunderstood
Absolutely.
Today.
Absolutely. You're correct, sir.
The Spanish Inquisition, you know, things of this sort. And yet, I have yet to, and you know, I am a scholar, I have a PhD, I'm a member of multiple academic societies, etc. I have yet to find a Christian leader who advocates those methods or says that, you know, hey, these things were good ideas. No, every time the Christian church looks back at it, saying that was wrong, and even the Crusades were greatly misunderstood, we say there were things that were done wrong there, that you know, the violence was not appropriate, and things of that sort. And you know, I think it says a lot about a group how the, I guess, rank and file and the leadership respond to these things. You know, you compare that with, you know, say, the communist countries of, say, the Soviet Union.
Sure, sure.
You know, was there ever a great apology that, you know, what Stalin did was bad? No.
Matter of fact, they're digging him up and displaying him in,
you know,
in Wall Street.
I mean, Khrushchev, I think, somewhat disagreed with Stalin and tried to bury Stalin's memory, but yet not saying that, you know, this is anathema to communism by any stretch. You know, and you can go on, you know, look at Islam, again, there's the violence, and a lot of people say, well, that's not what Islam's really about, but yet nobody is really standing up and saying, this is wrong, this is anti-Muslim or whatever. Whereas in the Christian church, whenever there has been violence in the name of Christianity, and you know, we have stood up and said, wait a minute, this is an abuse. This is wrong. You know, and be that then, be that somebody today who is doing violence against, say, an abortion clinic or homosexual or anything else, this is wrong. This is not.
Well, and those are individuals. They're not. It's not being promoted by the church or any denomination. You got the wacky bunches
right.
up,
and,
like they're.
And that's my point.
But you know, but here's the thing, and this is what's really getting under my skin these days. Washington Times. So this is no website hack journalist, you know, guy going out. Here's the headline: Chechen women in mortal fear as president backs Islamic honor killing. Now, this is Islam. This is the religion of peace. You know, okay? This is the religion where everybody just has a warm, soapy hug and we all get along in the name of Allah. And here they are going to codify as state law in Chechnya, which was part of the old Soviet Union, honor killings. If you don't know what an honor killing is, if you have a young woman living in your family and she does something that you perceive to be a dishonor, you can dispatch her. I mean, and this is not new. I think the family name was Isa, but if you go back, and I think it was sort of in your neighborhood where your congregation is, probably 25 years ago now, maybe a little bit more, maybe it was back in the 80s, there were one of these honor killings that was captured on a 911 tape where the poor girl was screaming for her life as her father knifed her to death here in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Palestinian, I think it was a Palestinian family that migrated here.
Yeah, and we should note, too, that you know, when talking about doing something to dishonor the family, being the victim of rape is considered a dishonor. And here, and there have been numerous times where you have this poor young woman or girl, depending upon the age, who has been horribly victimized by somebody, and then the family feels she's guilty and she should be then punished and, if not, killed.
Yeah.
And,
oh, but the Christian Church, you persecuted the Crusades, you bad people, you. Excuse me? Really? You know, I'm sorry. Show me your medal for bravery and accuse one of these Islamic countries of what they do and see how long you last.
Yeah. You know, it is interesting. You hear a lot of these protests against the Christians and against the United States and that, and people say that, you know, we oppress women and that sort of thing, and it's always saying,
oh, really?
You know, please go to Afghanistan or Pakistan.
That's a good idea.
Can
we buy you a ticket? We'll pick up a collection for you. You know, like the guy who went to the journalism class, the pro-gay advocate who was there to give an anti-bullying lecture. I'll do more about this next week on the program. But, you know, and what happens? He winds up saying that the Bible is full of manure. I cleanse that because he's more graphic in what he said.
The text of his speech could not be read on the radio.
One person referred to him as a walking hate crime for how he, you know, talks about Christians and Roman Catholics and the rest. And as these Christian students got up and said, I'm not going to listen to this, what does he do? He berates and bullies them as they leave the room. You know?
Yeah.
But I'd love to take up a collection. So like you said, let's send him to Afghanistan. Make that statement about the Quran in Iran. Right. Make that statement about the Quran somewhere, maybe even in Turkey, and see what happens to you.
And that's where I think so much of this is actually really more political than anything. Because
this is not the
fact of the matter is, the Taliban or any Islamic government or wannabe government is not an issue for this individual. It's this society, and that's what he is trying to influence. And so, you know, while in one way we can see a great disconnect, on the other side, from his point of view, we're the ones who are the threat to him here.
Yeah.
He can't go out and do whatever he wants to and proclaim whatever he wants to, as he perceives it, at least, because there are conservative Christians who have the audacity to say, that's not right.
And it's not right because we make this stuff up as we go along. I think you can do it on a couple of different levels. Theologically, you can demonstrate why the behavior is not edifying, either to yourself or the culture. But you can also do it on a medical level and other levels like this. But no, we'll ignore the facts. Welcome to America 2012. You know, I deny your reality and prefer to create one of my own. I want to hand you a little bit of text term. Did you get that? There you go. I thought this was something else we talk about. But before we go to this particular article, just maybe 2 minutes quickly on vocation, going back to Pumphrey's question about why we talk about these things. We are called to a vocation as citizen. Now, I think this is where Lutheran theology is so spot on and so helps round and inform an individual in a worldview that we are people that are both, you know, of this world and of the next. And while we're in this world, we're called to a number of different vocations, and citizen is one of them.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And to kind of get on a soapbox here, as Scripture clearly tells us that we are to give to our government whatever we owe it, if taxes, taxes, if tribute, etc. As I firmly believe that as members, as citizens of a representative republic, such as the United States, one of the things that we owe our government is an informed vote.
Thank you.
And so,
thank you.
You know, we need to, and notice I said informed vote. It's not just enough to show up into the voting booth and say, oh, I like D's or I like R's, you know, behind their names. But really look at the issues, look at the personalities, the character of the individuals, and then vote and be and potentially active in other ways as well, as far as, you know, lobbying them if necessary, as President Harrison did, testifying before the Congress. You know, most of us aren't going to be called to testify before Congress, but, you know, whatever those things are, and that is part of that vocation as citizen of this nation, and we owe it to our neighbors to do this.
It's serving neighbor.
It is. You know, why do we have a government to protect us? But predominantly, we want to protect our neighbors. You know, we want to be worried about what is best for our neighbors. So you can look at things, say, even say the economy. Most of these issues in politics, it always bothers me because each party tends to say, we're the ones who care about the poor, the other ones don't, or, you know, whatever. And the fact of the matter is, as much as politicians care, and you can get cynical about that, but the fact of the matter is, I think both do have honest concerns. The question is who has better answers? And we need to pay attention to that and look at it and say, okay, you know, our economy, you know, thanks to the recession and this very, very weak recovery, there are a lot of families hurting. There are a lot of people out of work.
Yeah.
What is the best way to do this? Not this, this party has an answer, but that one doesn't, or vice versa, but rather look at both of the parties' answers and then decide which one do we believe is the best to help my neighbor to be able to get a job and provide for their family and all of that, and then vote accordingly.
You know, thank you, Pastor Helwig, for the clear exposition of the right way to approach religion and politics, or I should say faith and politics. Religion, that's a term that gets abused and is misunderstood.
Right.
Because there are some who would say that to be a Christian is to be a Republican, or to be whatever is to be, and that's not the case.
No.
You know, it is you in your sanctification doing what is best for your neighbor, and understanding that you can also do great harm to your neighbor.
Very much so.
Yeah, that's why I appreciate you saying that it has to be an informed opinion, an informed decision that one makes when they go into the voting booth. Let me run this by you very quickly here. We have a few minutes left. And again, this is why we do this program. National Day of Prayer. I don't know if that was yesterday or today or when.
Yesterday.
That was. It was yesterday.
I'm sorry, it's today. I'm meeting myself coming and going right now.
I pray every day, so I tend, you know.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, you're right. It is today.
Here is the official proclamation issued by the President of the United States when it comes to this National Day of Prayer. And I thought I'd read this to you. We'd look at it together, and then you maybe could comment as we go along. It says, prayer has always been a part of the American story, and today countless Americans rely on prayer for comfort, direction, and strength, praying not only for themselves, but for their communities, their country, and the world. Scale of 1 to 10, as far as accuracy about what prayer is?
Well, I mean, it's about as good as I expect from a politician, to put it simply.
Full of Christian speak. We talked about that yesterday on the program.
Yeah, and I mean that's, again, imbibed in our political culture in so many ways. The one thing is that obviously it's a very individualistic attitude of prayer, and that it's, you know, for my comfort, for my direction,
right,
for my strength.
Good catch, yeah.
And then he says, you know, then not only for themselves, but for our communities, our country, and the world.
Right.
And obviously we are to bring our needs to God in prayer, but I would think that we should also be aiming a bit more as my neighbor's comfort, my neighbor's strength, you know, and direction as needed as well as, you know, asking God to strengthen us, strengthen our bonds in that as well. And of course, with anything like this, there's a bigger question that lays behind this, and that is prayer to whom? You know,
well, let's read a little bit more and see if we can discern that.
It
goes on to say, on this National Day of Prayer, we give thanks for our democracy and the democracy that respects the beliefs and protects the religious freedom of all people to pray, worship, or abstain according to the dictates of their conscience. So you would pray to the one true God that people who want to abstain from knowing him have the right to do so.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very curious addition into this.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously, I think part of this is that
It's the National Day of Prayer, for crying out loud. Why do you have to recognize the atheists in your prayer?
Part of it has a lot of it has to do with politics, and
there you go.
I mean, this is a constituency of his, and so he is, you know, having to try to walk this line.
Let us pray for all the citizens of our great nation, particularly those who are sick, mourning, or without hope, and ask God for the sustenance to meet the challenges we face as a nation. Well, it's got God speak in it, but I'm not quite sure. Like you said, if you don't discern which God it is to whom you're praying, may we embrace the responsibility we have to each other and rely on the better angels of our nature in service to one another. You might have, as a theologian, you might have to parse that one for me and explain it.
Well, obviously, the better angels of our nature has become kind of a shorthand for...
We're basically good people?
Yeah, and kind of the good part in us. You know, it seems like kind of a way, and this is part of the popular culture, very much a part of the American ethos, that everybody has Satan sinner in them, even non-Christians.
Right.
You
right.
know, obviously, Scripture makes it clear that angels and humans are different creatures, different creations by God. But, again, this is kind of common parlance. Yeah, I'm not going to make a big deal about it. It's kind of like I would not browbeat somebody for saying that the sun rose this morning. Well, the sun doesn't rise.
Right.
Of course not. It's just a way of speaking. But, you know, obviously here it looks like the prayer that he or not, what he's urging us to pray for is ourselves, and that we can do a better job, that we can be better people, that we can make this world a better place, rather than God coming to us, God changing us, God improving our culture, God redeeming us, of course, in Christ, is where I would go immediately with these things.
Right.
But even if you want to take the redemption of Christ out of it, which is dangerous, but in the political realm, I understand they're wanting to do that, you know, it's all still about us doing things,
right,
rather than God doing things.
Let me get this one line in. We have about a minute left. It says, let us be humble in our convictions and courageous in our virtue. Well, again, Pramshree, this is why we do this program. How do you define convictions and how do you define virtues? Do you define it that Kathleen Sebelius, head of the Health and Human Services Department, says, attention churches, you shall offer abortion services to all? Wow, that's a great virtue, isn't it, Pastor?
Yeah, it's all a matter of who defines what, you know, and kind of what's, I think, lays behind a lot of this is convictions being your personal religious convictions, which you want to be humble about and don't push it on others and don't be too
thing.
But then in kind of the public virtue of being a nice person and that sort of thing, you know, that we should be courageous with. I would agree we should be courageous with that. And humble on our convictions only in so that far that as we're not saying that I have everything right because I'm such a wonderful, intelligent, brilliant person, but bold in it as far as God says this is true and I believe it, and I'm going to be honest about that and say I believe it, and you know, if I'm wrong, prove me wrong.
And that's called a true witness.
Yeah.
Pastor John Helwig serves at Emmaus Lutheran Church here in the city of St. Louis. You might want to consider joining him some Sunday. Thank you for my time. Thank you for your time. My time doesn't matter, but thank you, Pastor. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy coming in here.
Listen Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study Archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.
In the town of Odyssey, no one plans fun the way Eugene plans fun.
What video games do you have?
Well, actually, I've organized better activities than video games, Kyle. Math games, science experiments, periodic table charades.
So when the Meltzners offer to babysit for a friend, everyone is in for a bumpy ride.
Where are you going? The pole's that way.
I'm retrieving my car keys.
Don't miss the next adventure in Odyssey.
Saturday mornings at 8:30 on KFUO Radio.
You can provide for the people you love and the ministries you care about, including KFUO Radio, through a charitable estate plan. By establishing a charitable annuity, trust, or other planned giving instrument, you and your spouse may enjoy cash payments for life and at the same time leave a legacy gift for KFUO Radio. All you have to do is contact our gift planning specialist.
Call Joan Harwell at 800-844-0524. That's 800-844-0524.
We are where you are. KFUO Radio, Clayton, St. Louis. KFUO HD, streaming live at KFUO.org. AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. Now that some of Osama bin Laden's private correspondence has been posted online, what have we learned? We asked counterterrorism expert Brian Fishman of the New America Foundation what the takeaway message is from those documents seized from bin Laden's compound.
Bin Laden was in contact with al-Qaeda's affiliate organizations around the world, but he wasn't in clear control of those groups. And in fact, he was quite frustrated with their behavior at times, especially their lack of sort of political acumen and willingness to kill lots of Muslims around the world.
Al-Qaeda also complains in those documents that it couldn't find an American TV news network that it thought would reliably carry its message. The U.S. thought it had a deal with the blind Chinese activist who had holed up inside the U.S. embassy in Beijing. Now, Washington says Chen Guangcheng has changed his mind and wants to leave China with his family. Political analyst Joseph Cheng in Hong Kong says the U.S. looks kind of bad right now.
It put the American side on unfavorable light because it was not able to help Chen Guangcheng, and the dissident apparently openly told the outside world that he believed he had been let down.
Washington says it's going to talk more with Beijing about Chen's case now. The Obama administration has quietly informed the courts that if the president's health care law is struck down, Medicare's payment system could freeze up. The Supreme Court is deciding whether the health care law is constitutional. And economists are reminding us that we're going to see fits and starts as the economy tries to get back on track. Today, the big retailers like Costco and Macy's are reporting that revenue rose less than 1% in the worst performance since 2009, when the economy was just coming out of that very bad recession. This is AP Radio News.